It's a pleasure for me to introduce Bob again tonight. I'd like to tell you a couple of little stories about him. Oh my. The first year I was at the General Service Conference, the first thing Monday morning we talked about whether we wanted tape recorders or not, and it was viewed as a majority or a unanimous, I think Bob said, that everybody wanted tape recorders, delegates to be allowed to use tape recorders. Well, it wasn't quite unanimous, and one of the delegates brought it to Bob's attention that he had neglected to hear a minority opinion on it, and Bob apologized forthwith, so he, you can see, he's practicing his program. At this year's conference, I had the privilege of giving a presentation, and Bob was sitting about as close to me then as he is now. And I was right in the middle of saying whatever I had to say, and he turned to Mary Ellen to defend me. He says, "Hey, this is good," and just about wiped me out. I had a heck of a time finishing. But I enjoyed Bob, and it's been a real pleasure. I got a chance to show him around the Dr. Bob's grave and a few of the places in Akron yesterday, and we had a good time. So I'd like to introduce Bob Pearson. What group? From what group? From group 468? Group 468.
Okay. Thank you, Bob, and good evening, friends. My name is Bob Pearson, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Got my long-suffering friends here. It's been a long day, hasn't it? We got a few new faces, too, I'm glad to see. As Bob says, I am from the 468 group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which meets every Friday at 11:15 in the General Service Office, which is located at 468 Park Avenue South, and the group consists of the 13 members of Alcoholics Anonymous who work at the General Service Office. My home group is Greenwich, Connecticut. That's where I sobered up, or that's where I affiliated with AA anyway, and that's where I continue to go to my meetings. I just hope that those of you who are attending this conference are having as much fun out of it as I am. I've had a fine day and really looking forward to being with you tomorrow. And I again want to thank the committee and everyone responsible for inviting me out here and making it possible for me to be here and share with you. And I thank you for this last passing of the basket, which I presume will be enough to pay for my airplane trip home. And I'm grateful to Bob sincerely for showing me around yesterday. I have been really excited about coming out here for many weeks and even months to the cradle, really the cradle of AA, which is Cleveland and Akron, and you are pretty blasé about it out here, I'm sure, but it still is a profound thrill to someone like myself to come back and see that gatehouse where the first meeting took place. You just can't help but, when you see that, to think, my God, if it hadn't been for what happened there, I would not be here and I would not be alive. And at the cemetery, we got out and trudged through the snow over to this quiet grave and just looked at this simple man's simple marker, and it's very, very deeply moving. And of course, here in Cleveland, it's where the movement really got strong before it did any place else. This was the scene of the first growth, I kid you not. And so this is a sort of a special place too, the scene of the first international convention, and it's a very historic place to come back to. Well, I guess I should say right off that an old-timer happened to be down in Houston, Texas, where I heard this many, many years ago when I was first in AA and was on a business trip down there. But an old-timer said something in a meeting down there which sort of gave me a new viewpoint toward my own sobriety and toward AA, and it's really has stuck with me and kind of changed my life since. And what he said was, AA doesn't teach us how to handle our drinking. It teaches us how to handle sobriety. And just think about that. AA doesn't teach us how to handle our drinking. AA teaches us how to handle sobriety, which is what none of us could handle in the first place. And that's why we drank. At least that was certainly true in my case. And I think that most of us knew that the way to handle our drinking was to quit. If we didn't know that, there were sure enough people who were always telling us that. At least in my case, that was true. And indeed, I did quit once for a period of 10 months on my own. And at other times, I think all of us, most of us in AA, have quit drinking at one or a variety of times, sometimes because we're in jail or in a hospital, or otherwise can't get it, and sometimes because we're on a pledge or we have sworn off for Lent or what have you. And the problem, you see, then, is not really to stop drinking. The problem is to stay stopped. The problem is not to go back to drinking, not to have to go back to drinking. And that's the reason we have to go back to drinking is because we can't handle it sobriety without help. So I think that the very first time that I ever had a drink of alcohol, for some reason or other, I knew that I should quit, because it was only one small drink of sherry that my father gave me when I was 13 years old on a Christmas Eve that I was celebrating with the family, and he gave me a little drink of sherry to celebrate that Christmas Eve. And I can remember yet, of course, that kind of a thrill that I got and this warm, warm feeling as it spread through me. And I went to bed very shortly afterwards, and I remember as I went upstairs, and I was so excited and so exhilarated somehow or other by this experience, and yet I must have felt some deep-seated sense of guilt, because I remember when I said my, "Now I lay me down to sleep," you know, I ended up asking God or praying to God that I would never drink again. Now, I submit to you that this is hardly a, quote, normal, unquote, reaction of a 13-year-old child to his first drink of sherry wine. But nevertheless, that's actually what happened to me. But my prayer wasn't answered, because I did indeed drink later. And it was somewhat later because it was when I got to college. And, you know, went on the beer bus with the boys and the trips over to Kansas City. I was raised in the Middle West in Kansas, and I was an only child of loving parents who certainly gave me everything that I should have wanted or needed in the way of love and support. So I can't blame any drinking on them. I guess the only unusual thing about my childhood is that my father and our family moved around a very great deal. In fact, I went to a different school every single year from the time that I started the school until the time that I got to high school. And what this meant was that I, as an introverted, shy, scrawny kind of a kid, would move into a new town, and I would start school, and of course the boys would test you out, you know, and you'd end up in a fight, and I would end up getting beaten up. Not once, usually, but a number of times, you know. This is just part of going into any new school, right? And so then, as the months would go by, I would eventually, and very painfully usually, acquire a friend or two, you know, that I really clung to and that meant a very great deal to me. And about the time that I did this, then Dad would pull up stakes and we'd move to a new location, and when school started, I'd go through it all over again. I don't mean to sound as if I had an unhappy childhood, because I certainly didn't think it was unhappy at the time, nor I do now in looking back on it. But nevertheless, I did have this feeling of never really fitting in. And the result that it had on me really was that I turned very early to a lot of daydreaming and a lot of fantasizing. And I sort of retreated into a kind of a dream world, as a kid will, or even as some of us adults will on occasion. And I indeed continued in this fantasizing and dream world really all through my life and all through my alcoholism up to the time that I came to AA. And the other thing that, the other effect that this had was that I became a great overachiever in school, because this is where I got my strokes, you see. I was a great reader. I turned to books. I read an awful lot of books. And I went to a lot of movies. That was, of course, a part of this fantasizing, I suppose. But as a result of this reading lots of books, I did real well in school, and I became a real overachiever. With the result that when I got to high school, I was editor of the high school paper, and when I went on to college, I edited the college yearbook, and I was moving in the direction of becoming a writer, which was my profession. In fact, I started a business of writing themes and theses for people in all, not only in my own school, but in a lot of other schools, 8 different schools and colleges, on a mail order basis, finally, to put my way through school. And I got into some trouble over that, which is not pertinent to this story here, but what happened was that just shortly before I graduated from college, I sold an article about my experiences as a campus ghostwriter to a magazine called Scribner's Magazine. Some of you people who are as old as I am may remember it. And that was later, the article was picked up by Reader's Digest. Well, this is very heady stuff to a kid in school. And so I immediately figured that I was, you know, God's gift to the literary world, and as soon as college was over with, I beat it back to New York to make my way as a writer. Well, this was in the midst of the recession of 1938, and the only job that I could get there was with a big company working on their company magazine. And it was a very good job for a 21-year-old. And again, I did real well there, and sort of thought of myself, you see, by this time as a kind of a boy wonder. And I think that a lot of other people around me were giving me this kind of credit at this particular period of my life, and I think this is important in what comes later. But the other thing that happened because of this is that I got a job, you see, with mostly people who were older than I was, and certainly a heck of a lot more sophisticated than I was, coming back from Kansas in my green gabardine suit and my two-tone shoes and a Homburg hat. Dig that, will you? A Homburg hat I wore to look older. But anyway, as a 21-year-old, I began to go down with the people that I associated with for a drink after work. And we would go down, and Manhattans were very big in those days. And we used to go down and drink Manhattans after work. And this was pretty suave, believe you me. In fact, I had my first blackouts, I guess, at this time, the comical kind where you can't remember, you know, getting home the night before and ha, 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 and what did I do then, and this kind of thing. And then along came World War II, and I went into the Navy as a writer, and then when things got hot, I went out to sea as a gunnery officer on a destroyer escort. And it was in the Navy that I first had my first disciplinary problems because of drinking. And the first time that it happened was on the way back from escorting a convoy across the Atlantic, and we stopped in the Azores on the way back. And I can remember getting off the ship, and we were sightseeing ashore, and I can remember waving the bottles of wine out the side of the car, you know, with my feet up on the seat as we were sightseeing around. And then we came back to the town of Horta, and I switched to the native brandy, and I got just absolutely smashed and barely made the last gig back to the ship that night, and just got there in time to make an absolute mess of the wardroom and all of the quarters. With the result, then I was hauled up before the captain's mast, and he said to me, "Pearson, you're a good officer, but you drink too much." Well, of course, this just passed over the top of my head at the time. The only result, as far as I was concerned, was that when we got back to New York, where I really wanted to go on a liberty and put one on, I was confined to my quarters with an armed guard outside and never did get ashore on that trip. So that could have been a red flag, but it wasn't. And I began to court my wife at that time, She's a very lovely, lively gal who loved to drink, as I loved to drink. So our courtship was mainly in the bars and the nightclubs of New York. And when we were married, while I was still in the Navy on a brief leave from the ship, we went down to a resort in the Poconos, and I remember we had bottles of iced champagne in silver buckets by the bedside, day and night, throughout the entire honeymoon, which sort of set the tone and the pattern of the way that I was to at least picture my drinking for the next several years. Well, the war was over, and I came back to New York and got a job back with my company again after a brief stint with one of the national magazines. And by the age of 29, I was beginning to have noticeable trouble in managing my life. I was really having trouble coping with life because of booze. Let me just backtrack a moment and give you a little indication of this, perhaps a little ahead of time. This happened just a few months ago. We were out on a trip, and Betsy, my wife, and I were sitting on a park bench looking out over the Pacific out in California, and she was, you know, getting ready to listen to me make my thousandth talk that she'd heard in AA. And she said, "Did you ever think of trying to introduce some new material into your story?" And I said, "Well, what did you have in mind?" And she said, "Well, do you remember?" And then she told me the story, and sure enough, I didn't remember. So, so let me tell you this, because this took place in the war years, and it was in the last year of the war, and we lived in Washington, D.C. And one night, we didn't have a car, and I had borrowed my brother-in-law's car, that was mistake number one, to go to a party which was be held clear across town from in Washington from where we lived. So we got over there, and we had one whale of a party, and it lasted till all hours of the morning. We got back in the car, and of course, Betsy wanted to drive. And of course, I would have none of it, you know, insulted at the very thought. So I got behind the wheel of the car, apparently, and we started back home. And sure enough, the guy in front of me stopped too quick, and I smashed into the back of this car in front of me. And somehow or other, I had a heavy sense of responsibility. So I don't even remember, she didn't either, what happened to him. He was probably drunk, too, and would drove off, I don't know. But anyway, there I was with my car, and the front smashed in, and I had this obsession that I had to report this to the police, you know. So I said, "Now you stay here and I'll go find the police." See? So I left Betsy sitting in the car, and this was in a very rough part of Washington. I mean a real rough part of Washington. And I'd hate to be there in the daytime maybe, let alone at night. And so I left her, and as she tells it, you know, 10 minutes went by, 20 minutes went by, half hour, 45 minutes, I don't show up. So she gets all of her courage together, and she gets out of the car, and she goes a block or two to and found an outside phone booth, and she goes in and she calls the police and to see if I'm there. She thought they might, you know, lock me up once I got there, staggering as I was. They'd never seen me, never heard of me, and couldn't care less about the accident. So then, in kind of not knowing what else to do, she called home, our apartment. And after two or three rings, I answered the phone. And I said, "Where in the world are you?" She said she her heart sank. Because she said she knew it would do no good at all to scold me about this, or, you know, but we'd only been married a few months at this time, so can you imagine how this gave her the idea of what she was going to live with for the next few decades, okay? So, anyway, I get back to New York, and I'm having this sort of troubles by the time I'm 29. Now, are they telling me something? I had a great deal of trouble with tremors, with shaking. And I mean not just the kind of shaking that you have from hangovers, but I had some sort of a nervous or neurotic shaking and a real, real quakes. And as a matter of fact, there's a fellow in our group, and I dearly love, he never talks about them as shapes. He always calls them the leaves, you know. And that was the kind of thing that I had trouble with. And I discovered sort of along this time of my life that if I would take drink, that it would immediately calm down these shapes. And as long as I kept liquor inside of me, I didn't have this trouble of eating soup or eating other things or handling a glass, you know, without shaking it or signing my name or all of the other things that we have trouble with. And believe me, from that moment on, I was really hooked on alcohol because I really couldn't cope and couldn't live, really, from that moment on without being under the influence. I was, of course, by this time sneaking drinks. People would come to the house, I'd fix a drink, and just routinely, of course, I would have a belt for myself in between the drinks that I was fixing in the kitchen. I was beginning to, my career, if you want to call it that, when I was, well, I was just no longer a boy wonder. And I was beginning to be no longer a boy, for one thing, and I was certainly no wonder in my career by this time. It had sort of begun to drift. And I guess this was disappointing to me, and it was disquieting to me, and I learned that there was a lot of comfort, boy, in that bottle. That as long as I had a few drinks, this didn't worry me very much, this business about what was happening to this great career of mine. And you know, I think this is a kind of an aside, but then this is my personal opinion, as everything is that I say here. But I really think that this is something that we hear so often in AA. People who have had very high expectations of themselves, whether it's Queen of the Mardi Gras, you know, or the Bell of the Ball, or what have you, or some great promise early in their lives in athletics or business or something else. And then somehow or other later on, their performance doesn't live up to this expectation that we have of ourselves. And that's painful. I learned that liquor kind of helped bridge this gap between the expectations and the performance. But I think what happens is that this immediately starts a kind of a snowball effect, because the more that we drink, the more unreasonable and fantastic our expectations of ourselves become. And of course, the more we drink, the worse our performance becomes. And therefore, the gap between this expectation of what's going to happen to us tomorrow and what is actually happening to us, this gap becomes wider, so you have to drink more, and that causes it to become wider, and you're really caught in this rat race that we're all so familiar with. It was about this time that I quit drinking hard liquor for a period of several months. I didn't quit drinking because I switched to wine. In my very wine. It was too sweet and it was too cloying to me, so I switched then rapidly to Bass Sal, and then to Ballantine's Ale, and still I wasn't getting the kick that I wanted, and so I added a shot of vodka to the Ballantine's Ale, a sort of a Russian Boilermaker, if you will. And I drank this as my drink for all the rest of the time that I drank from that time on. It's from the age of about 29 on, the best bars and the finest clubs and everything else. I always had a shot of vodka chased with a Ballantine's Ale. So I changed my drinks. At the same time, I thought I was having a nervous breakdown. I was having this tremor trouble and all these other troubles with my life. My things just weren't going right in my life, I'll tell you. So I turned to religion. And I became very religious and a good church man, and remained actually a good church man through the rest of my drinking. And I think really that perversely, being a church man and having a faith really prolonged my drinking by a good deal. I mean, I would have fallen apart earlier had I not had some inner resources, some inner spiritual resources to kind of fall back on. And it sort of helped solve my problems there for a while, you see. And so I was able to really drink longer and get a lot sicker. I was filled with sort of this bewilderment of the fact that something was happening to me and I didn't know exactly what. So, of course, I pin my reasoning on other things and other people around me, and I begin to build up the familiar resentments that we're all familiar with. For example, there was sometime along in here, I was in line for a promotion with my company, and this, again, is in line with this not living up to your expectations, because I knew I was going to get this promotion. There was only one other person who had a chance to get to be a manager of this department other than myself, someone Carl. We didn't like each other very much because we were real rivals for this opening, you see. And it was years before this opening ever came up, and we were jockeying for position all this while in this company. Well, finally, the guy who had this job, the manager, moved up to vice president, and the job was open, see. And boy, we practically jammed ourselves in the doorway going through at the same time to go into our boss, you see, and see which one of us got the job. Guess what? Neither of us got the job. They picked a dark horse, a guy that you would never in your wildest dreams believe would ever be boss of me, you know. A fellow who worked for both of us, really, out in this department, and he became our boss. Man, talk about your resentment. This just burned us up. It was about 3 days before they could find either one of us. We were out really drinking, and we became buddies over the bar from that point on, and still are. And then, of course, they started this fantasizing that I'm talking about. I would go down to the English Grill in Rockefeller Center, which was my great watering hole, and I could sit down there over a drink, you know, and I would figure I could smuggle a gun into the office, and I could shoot this son of a, you know. And then I could throw the gun out of the 42nd story window and nobody would know where it came from. See? And I could picture this guy dying. And this became a sort of a tape that I played over and over and over in my mind, you know, just full of hate and bitterness. And oh, I was a sick cookie, believe me. And so I was having trouble dealing with criticism. In my kind of business, a lot of people work on your writing, you know, and people are always changing it, and people are always asking you to do things to it, and this is perfectly normal with all writers, but to me, I resented every single thing that was ever changed about my copy, and God help me if anybody really, bawled me out or really criticized me. This I just couldn't cope with unless I ran to a bottle and had a drink, and boy, then I could cope with it real well. So, increasingly, drink was becoming my answer to everything. If I had an important business presentation that I had to make, of course I had to fortify myself with a cup of drink. Didn't we all? You know? If you had a special social occasion that was particularly important to you, of course you had to really loosen up a little bit with a couple of belts before you went out, you know. Then you could cope with the situation real well. Of course, the catch became to control this drinking in this grim sort of way so that you wouldn't go over that line, and of course that's what you always did toward the end, at least, on these important business presentations. At the time that it was most important to me to be at my best, of course I would make a damn ass of myself because I was too loaded. And again, toward the end, just to give you an illustration, my wife's family were celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary. Now remember, I'm an only child, and I marry into this large and loving family, and I did love them all. Is it an emergency? No. So I was real pleased that the family was gathering, her family, my wife's family, was gathering from all over the country at our house, maybe 30 people, something like that, to celebrate this 50th wedding anniversary. And by this time, my habit in drinking had come to the point that my wife, who never bugged me about my drinking, she was seemed to have been sort of born with an inherent Al-Anon sense, you know, of not to bug me about my drinking. But on this particular day, she said, "Now remember, tomorrow night, or tonight rather, is a big night, and today, just today, can you be sort of careful, sweetheart, and don't have too big a lunch?" That was sort of the code word, you know, saying off the booze, "Don't have too big a lunch. And come home and we'll have a good time here tonight." So you know what happened. I had a very big lunch, a very long lunch. No food, but a long lunch. commuter train that night with my coat buttoned up crooked, you know, and the hat on the side of the head, and staggered down onto the train platform, and you know how heartbroken the poor gal was. So she didn't say anything to me. She picked me up. She drove me back to the house, and everybody was out in back in the patio having their drinks. And so I was to freshen up, you see, and join them. And of course, the first thing I did was head to the bar where I really needed a drink, you know. I don't remember too much of what happened after that, except that, maybe a half hour later, I remember them hauling me out from under the grand piano where I had taken refuge with my drink hugged to me, because I knew that they were going to take it away from me. And sure enough, they did. And they sent me to my room. And I was at this time 42 years old. And that's where I remained for the rest of that evening. So that's the way that I was having some trouble coping with life. This was from, say, age 29, increasingly and progressively until this age of 42. Now, somewhere in there, rather early on, I was transferred for one year to New Orleans. Anybody who's ever been in New Orleans knows this, that it is the alcoholic paradise. There are places on Bourbon Street, there are bars there that opened in the War of 1812 and have been open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week ever since. And it's the only place that I have ever been where it's really socially acceptable to drink at breakfast. I mean, if you go for breakfast at Brennan's, literally the first thing they do is give you a drink list, you know, so that you can order your Sazerac or your Gin Fizz before you start out with breakfast. This is my kind of town. I went down there with a drinking problem, believe me, but I came back a roaring alcoholic, and I mean that seriously. And I moved back at that time to Greenwich, Connecticut, and started this commuting. Now, my day at this time went something like this. I would get up in the morning and, you know, swing my feet over the edge of the bed and try to face the new day. And at a closed meeting not too long ago, people were talking about the great benefits that they had gotten out of AA, and one of the people there said, the greatest benefit that I've gotten out of AA is to be able to face a new day. And I identified immediately with that, because at this time of my life, I knew when I got out of bed that the day was going to be a disaster. It was just a question of whether I could stave off the bad things that I knew were going to happen to me. So I would get out of bed, and I would go into the closet, and I would shuffle around in my pockets for these little nips. Now, they don't allow you to sell liquor in smaller than half pints in New York, so they disguise it as lemon-flavored vodka, and this is like a liqueur, see, so you can sell it in these 4-ounce bottles. And I used to buy these, and I would secret them away in my clothes all over, so that I could carry the booze with me, right? So in the morning, there would be dozens of these scattered through my clothes, and so I could find one that wasn't empty, you know, and I could have a belt. And then I would rush into the bathroom and, of course, lose it. And then if I was lucky, I could find another belt, and that one would stay down, and then I would go in and shower and shave and get ready and go downstairs, and my wife would have gotten up and gotten breakfast for me. Now, this was, of course, another disaster, the first of the disasters, really, because she would fix a perfectly lovely breakfast for me, and by this time, I had absolutely quit eating, and I could not face food, and particularly breakfast. It just made me almost wretched to look at it, and so I would push the food around the plate, you know, and then say, gee, it's time we were going. And so she would go out and get the car out of the garage, see, and I would scrape the food off the plate into the garbage can, and if I was lucky, I could get into the pantry and get a belt of vodka before I got out and talked the other way out of the car all the way to the station, you know. Or if I didn't do that, I would shake and sweat and in absolute misery, scared to death somebody was going to speak to me, so I'd have to speak back to them. And I would cringe in one corner of the train all the way in, an hour's trip into New York. When I would get in there, I would make a beeline for Hurley's and Daly's Bar over at 49th and 6th Avenue in those days, now gone, I guess, which was, it opened early. That was what was great about Hurley and Daly's. And it had a fine clientele consisting of a few derelicts from 6th Avenue and one of these tour guides who stands on the corner and hawks the bus rides around Manhattan, and he was getting ready for his day's work at the same time I was getting ready for my day's work. So I would have my first vodka and ale of the day, reasoning at that time that they couldn't be too critical of me if they smelled beer on my breath, you see, so it was really all right. In fact, there was a cartoon that appeared in a magazine around this time that I remember really clearly identifying with, and it showed a situation like this: a man in a business suit and a fedora hat at a bar, and it was obviously 9 o'clock in the morning. You know, the clock said 9, and it was light outside, so it was obviously 9 o'clock in the morning. And next to this man on the at the bar was a rather seedy-looking character sitting on a bar stool, and the businessman has his glass up like this, and he's saying, "This is the part of the vicious circle that I like best." And that's just the way that I felt. Then I would go up to work and watch my clock, and at about 10:15, it was coffee break time. Well, when everybody else went for the coffee break, I made a beeline for the elevator downstairs to the English Grill, and there was a group of us who met in there every day at 10:15 for our drinks. Very successful guys, most of them, so I could rationalize, sure, it's all right for me to drink this way. Look at them. They drank that way. Most of them, incidentally, were later dead or in AA. Very few of them in AA. Most of them dead from alcohol. One guy blew the top of his head off with a shotgun, and another one drove his car off of a cliff in Colorado, and they had that kind of a life. But at this time, this was what we call our breakfast club. We met down there, and there was another cartoon that I identified with about this situation, because this cartoon showed a big room, a kind of a bullpen type of place with rows and rows of desks, you know, and they're all empty except for one right in the middle of the room. And there's a man at this one desk, and the only thing unusual about him is that he has a bottle of booze up to his lips and he's drinking it like this. And over on one side of the room, there's a couple of boss type of characters, you know, unbeknownst to him, and they're speaking to each other, and one of these boss type characters is saying to the other, "I want you to notice that. No half-hour coffee breaks, no hanging around the water cooler, just one quick belt and back to work." So after my bell downstairs, I'd get up, I'd get back to work, I'd go back down to the English Grill for a couple of drinks before lunch, I'd make it through to the middle of the afternoon, have another little refresher there, then I'd beat it for the train right after work, and I'd stop and pick up a couple of these nips, you see, and put them in the pocket. I'd get on the train, go to the bar car, sit down to my gin rummy game, and a funny thing happened there too, because there's nothing to keep you from ordering drinks on a bar car. I mean, that's what the bar car is there for. And so I would order a vodka and an ale, and I would start my card game. And as soon as the first drink was done, between hands, I would excuse myself, go into the next car, which you had to do, to go in to the men's room on the train. When I got in there, I would open up one of these nips and take a drink out of the bottle, you know, screw it up, put it back in my pocket, walk back into the bar car and order another drink. Now, it was years later, after I got into AA, that I read in the AA Grapevine the definition of an alcoholic. An alcoholic is a person who drinks between drinks. Well, I get home, and we always had a cup of cocktails before dinner, so I fixed a couple of drinks for my wife, but it was not generally a very happy time by this time. I had a couple of kids, 3 kids actually by this time, growing kids, and I was the captain of my ship when I was home under these circumstances, and at the slightest infraction of my rules, you know, I would send one child to one room, another child to another room, and then Betsy would get in tears over the way that I was treating the children, and I thought she wasn't strict enough, and then I would go sulk, you know, and I would go into the bar and have a drink while I was sulking, see. And, of course, I was still drinking between drinks when I was fixing her drinks. So she always had a lovely dinner for us, a lovely candlelight dinner in the dining room. And she really tried to make it just as nice and attractive as possible to come home to. And, of course, by this time, I was absolutely moped by this time of the day. And she would try to keep up a bright conversation, and I'd be back to this business of shoving the food around the plate and answering in monosyllables. And after this charming dinner scene, then I would go upstairs and sit in front of television and try to make the image come in, you know, to focus. And then I would need a little nightcap before I went to bed, and then I would go to bed. And I would wake up in the middle of the night about this time, full of dread, full of fears, again, dreading the coming of the dawn, with things sort of swimming in front of my eyes, you know, these sort of shapes that float in front of your eyelids when you close them or open them, and sweating and needing a drink, something terrible, and really not being able to even get up and get it. I was too embarrassed to do that. And then becoming aware that my wife in the double bed next to me was crying into the pillow in the middle of the night, and knowing that it was me that was causing this, but also knowing at the same time that there was nothing in the world that I could do about it. I mean, at this stage of my life, I absolutely had to drink. I could not function without drinking. I could not cope at all with life without drinking. And so there was no choice. If it was making her that unhappy, that's just the way the ball bounces, baby. That's just about my attitude, because there was just nothing I could do about it. Well, that was sort of my day at this time. And when I was about 40 years old, I developed a lump in my abdomen down here, and I was afraid, because I was fat at this time, and I was sick, I was feeling bad anyhow, and I felt this lump, and I thought it might be a tumor, you know. And so finally I screwed up my courage, and I went to see my family doctor. And it was a funny thing, because he set me down on a table, and he felt my abdomen in here, and he said, "Bob," he said, "how much do you drink?" I didn't know what this had to do with tumors, but I said, adding it up, as I just recounted it to you, and I said, "Oh, you know, 8 or 9 drinks a day," and not telling him that each one of these was really a double, but really being as honest as I could about it. And I didn't know it, but this doctor was a very abstemious kind of a guy, and a drink a week would have been a lot for him. So when I said 8 or 9 drinks a day, he said, "You mean every day?" And I said, "Sure, every day." And he said, "I think we know what's wrong with you." And so, sure enough, I had a badly enlarged liver. And he said, I had to quit drinking. So it was on this occasion that I quit for 10 months on my own, without the help of AA, and really at the time that I thought I could not live without drinking, when fear of this cirrhosis of the liver, which I was right on the brink of, I was able to quit for 10 months. But those 10 months, of course, my business presentations were continuing, my social occasions were continuing, my gap in my performance was continuing, all the things that I had to deal with in my sobriety were continuing, and I didn't have the booze to fall back on. So, naturally, I was thinking all the time about drinking, all those 10 months. And at the end of that time, the doctor said, "Your liver looks real good." He says, "I think it's about as good as it'll ever be." And I said, "Well, John," I said, "does that mean that, you know, on a hot summer's day, I could have a cold beer after I've been out cutting the lawn, or perhaps I could have a fine wine with dinner?" which was a crock, that I had never had a fine wine with dinner, although taking all of my drinking history. But he said, in reply, the fatal words that a doctor can say to an alcoholic, or anyone can say to an alcoholic, he said, "Well, one won't hurt you." He, I think, has learned a lot more about alcoholism since. I hope he has, because, of course, the first thing I did was get on the train. I went back into the English Grill, and I said, "Sam, set them up. We're back in business again." And I had one drink, and of course, nothing did happen to it. And maybe it was 2 or 3 weeks before I had another one. And then it was Christmas season, and, you know, I had a couple of drinks at a Christmas party, and then I had to go on a business trip. By the time I got back from that 3 weeks, I was drinking in just the same pattern that I had described to you earlier. Not wanting to this time. This is the alcoholic not able not to drink. I mean, I was drinking against my will, and again, bewildered by this, and yet there it was. Well, I drank for 2 more years, and during these 2 years, of course, I sickened very badly. By very shortly, of course, my liver went over the hill into cirrhosis of the liver, and my blood no longer would clot, which meant that I had all kinds of terrible bleeding episodes, nosebleeds so bad that I had to go to the emergency room a couple of times from the office, bleeding of gums and eyes and all the other places that you can imagine. It was just a mess. I got terrible weakness. I was so weak that I couldn't even lift my suitcase when I had to go on trips. I couldn't get the suitcase up to the train platform. I traveled mostly by train in those days. There was a faucet in our house that worked pretty hard to know to turn on and off. I got so weak I couldn't turn the damn faucet on and off, if you can imagine. And of course, I wasn't supposed to be drinking now, right? I mean, I was a sick cookie. I was not supposed to be drinking, so all my drinking was underground. And instead of the little nips, I now carried a quart of vodka with me in my briefcase everywhere that I went. And instead of, when I got in the morning into Grand Central Station, instead of heading for Hurley's and Daly's bar with the merry bit about this is the part of the vicious circle that I like best, I would get off the train and I would head for the men's room of Grand Central Station, and I would get back there in one of those dingy, grimy booths, and I would get the paper bag out of the briefcase and get the top off, you know, with trembling fingers, and get it up to my lips, filling it down my chin while I got enough down to be able to totter on to work. And of course, I couldn't go down at a coffee time to the English Grill anymore, so at coffee time, I would pick up my little briefcase and go out to the men's room where I worked. So you can imagine what a secret it was by this time that Pearson had a drinking problem. My wife was in absolute despair, didn't know what was to become of her and the kids. The kids were avoiding me. My boss started giving me warnings. My life was absolutely falling apart. My doctor said, you keep this up and you're going to have a massive esophageal hemorrhage. And he tried to describe to me the horrible death that comes to the alcoholic who has liver trouble. And I listened, but I didn't hear. And I went right on. I had no choice. I had to drink this way. So I went on a business trip out to Chicago, and the thing that the doctor warned me about happened out there. I had been carousing for 4 days. I use a word that my mother was very fond of, carousing. If you want a definition of that later, see me after the meeting. But I had been carousing for 4 or 5 days, and enough to kill me anyhow, really, even if I hadn't been in such bad shape, working all day and up all night. And I got a massive esophageal hemorrhage, and I lost pints of blood, vomiting rectally and so on, going in and out of a coma. I remember sitting in a little park across from the Blackstone Hotel, and it was around this time of year, and it was a day about like today. It was a real bleak kind of a day anyway, and I was sitting out there trying to get a breath of fresh air, and every few minutes, you know, going over to the bushes to lose more blood, I was thinking that, wallowing in self-pity, and the little thinking that I could do, and thinking that, well, it's best if I do go ahead and die, because my wife is young and pretty, and she could remarry, and the kids would have a good father that way, and, I wouldn't be missed, and so on. And I was in this kind of a very serious way of thinking, and then it occurred to me that there I was, 1,300 miles from home, and I was in Chicago, and who wants to die in Chicago? So I left the hotel, called their house doctor, and he just took about one look at me and found out what was wrong with me. And he had apparently seen some cases like this before, because the next thing I knew, the sirens were screaming and the ambulance was there, and I was in a stretcher and in the ambulance and a tube in the arm and in the hospital and tubes in both arms for intravenous feeding and blood transfusions. And damn near died, of course. But obviously I didn't, and the doctors told me that if I ever had another drink, that it might well be my last. And so naturally, I learned my lesson. Right? Wrong. I got back to New York and home, and I guess it was a couple of months after that, really, that a bunch of us were going off to a football game, and who ever heard of going to a football game without a drink? So I had one drink, and you know, not knowing anything about AA, not knowing that it was the first drink that got you drunk, then I was off again. And to make a long story a little bit shorter, I had two more of these massive esophageal hemorrhages. And in the second one, where I came nearest to dying, where I lost a liter of blood or something in one vomiting, I became, strangely enough, you know, you get enough of somebody else's blood back into your veins and you bounce back pretty rapidly as far as being able to get around. So I was back on my feet again, and they said that I was ambulatory. So even though I had bandages on my arms from these transfusions and everything else, I pulled on my clothes and I ambulated out of the front door of the hospital and down to a liquor store, which was about a block away, got a bottle of vodka, put it under my coat and smuggled it back into the hospital, put it in the wastebasket, and was sucking away on the vodka while I was lying there in the hospital. Now, I didn't have too much trouble identifying with the second step when I got here. But believe me, I see heads nodding. You know exactly what I was going through and that I had to do that. I had to do that. I had no choice. So it was at this time that my doctor, my long-suffering doctor, said to me that he could no longer be responsible for my well-being. And he just resigned my case. And he said that the only thing that I could do, as far as he was concerned, was go to a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist that he suggested was one who happened to practice in the same suite of offices that he did there in Greenwich. Now just listen, if this isn't the higher power watching out for you, because the only reason he sent me to this doctor was because he was in the same suite of offices, but that doctor's name was Dr. Harry Thibault. Isn't that fantastic? The one man in the world who probably knew more about about alcoholism than any other doctor or any other professional man. And as a matter of fact, at that very moment, when I went to him, he was serving as a non-alcoholic member of the Board of Trustees of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he didn't let me know that, of course. And what he did was persuade me to admit that I might have a little trouble with drinking. Not an alcoholic, mind you. No, not that. But that I might be having a little trouble with drinking. And that I might get help from AA. So he said, may I call him for you? And I said, yes, in his office. And so he called, and the man who was to become my sponsor came to the hospital, and he saw me. And he was a guy who was a robust fella. He was a black belt karate and a successful lawyer, and he drove a sports car, and he had a big mustache and a laugh, a ho-ho-ho kind of laugh, and was just the kind of guy who was obviously enjoying the hell out of life, and he was a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous and was just the kind of a guy that I needed at that precise moment in my life. Well, I wish I could tell you that I came to AA and quit drinking, but I was too sick. I was too far gone. I did start to come to meetings, and I came to a lot of meetings over a period of about a week and a half when I got out of that hospital. And I liked what I saw, I liked what I heard, but to me it was a front, and it was a good way for me to just keep on drinking, which is what I did, but more secretly than ever now, and really underground. And I wasn't supposed to be, touching it at all, so I had to really sneak. And so this brings us up to July 3rd of 1961, Now, on July 3rd of 1961, the town of Old Greenwich, Connecticut, had its July 4th fireworks display, which is confusing enough to start with, but nevertheless, that's what it was. We went out, the family went out to a picnic beforehand with a bunch of other families, and we had the hot dogs and so on, and there was an open bar there, and so I was sneaking in and getting through. I had plenty to drink already that day, but I really took a lot more on at this little gathering, and so as dusk fell and it came time to go down to the fireworks demonstration, I piled the family in the car, and you know, this was a sad scene. My poor wife was really at wit's end by this time, and we got down to the fireworks display, and we were late naturally, and so I let the family off to go into this little park and get settled, and I went to park the car and had to walk back to this park, and by the time I got back there, you know, it was real dark, and there's people all over the place, and I'm sick, and I'm drunk, and I'm, you know, confused, and it's a terrible thing. And I'm stumbling around over people, except that every once in a while it would go, "Boo!" You know, and down would come trickling these lights all around me, you know. And I could see them, you know, and so I would look around at these people, and they would be looking back up at me, and it was like a nightmare. It was just like a nightmare. And then I'd stumble over more people, and it would go, "Boo!" again, you know, and then I could see. So this went on for about 10 or 15 minutes, couldn't find the family anywhere, and then it was boo, bang, 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 boo, and that was the end of the fireworks demonstration. And the band came on and played the Star Spangled Banner, and everybody stood up, picked up their blankets, and went home. There I was. I reasoned to myself, well, I guess what's happened is that the family has probably gone back to the car. Then I realized that, by God, the family didn't know where the car was parked. Then I realized I didn't know where the car was parked. And so I just sort of trailed out of this park after the people who were going up with their baby carriages and their blankets up a little hill there. And I got about halfway up, and the impact of my whole life came sweeping over me, really seriously, and I just suddenly realized that my life, I didn't have the words to put it in, but my life was totally unmanageable. And so I just sat down on the curb and cried. And I was weeping bitter tears there when my dear sister-in-law, who lives next door to us, found me and put her arms around me and led me back to the car, and we got in the car and went home. And I want to tell you that it was a beautiful, classic AA scene there in my kitchen, because there was a member of AA who was waiting for me in my own kitchen with the big book spread out on the kitchen table, all ready to 12-step me. Now, there was only one thing wrong with this classic scene. He was drunker than I was. This was a guy who had been around the program, I think, for 3 days. And he had seen me down there in the park, and he was undertaking his first 12-step call, by God, all by himself. The poor guy drank for a good many more years, but he's now in the program and a very dear friend of mine and doing fine. But anyway, I went on to bed that night. I got up on the morning of July 4th, and I was faced with a confrontation by my wife and my doctor, who was over there, and my minister, who had done this. Is on 4th of July morning, on a holiday morning, and these people are all down there on my porch, and they have decided that I must be institutionalized. And so they were really arguing over where I was going to go. Somewhere along the line, somebody had poked a finger into my chest in an AA meeting, and they said, "Where you belong is High Watch Farm," naming the name of a drunk farm, really the original drunk farm in the whole country, I think. Run strictly along AA lines, a perfectly marvelous, marvelous place. So I ended up being, on July 4th of 1961, I was thrown into a drunk bar, and that was where I ended my drinking career. Something happened up there. When I went in, I was full of these resentments, I was full of hate, I was full of self-pity, I was a cesspool of every kind of a bad human emotion that a person can have. But somehow up there at this beautiful farm and this spiritual atmosphere among people like you who were up there as guests, you know, helping the people who were up there and as patients, they they began to get through to me somehow or other, and in the sort of little chapel meetings that they had up there, I began to get a glimmer of a spiritual awakening, I guess you'd say. I began to feel the presence of God in my life and begin to see that there was a possibility, at least, a hope, if you will, of living in this outside world normally without having to drink, as I had had to drink for so long. So I came back to Greenwich, and I affiliated with the Greenwich group there, and reluctantly at first, because I didn't think I could really make it. And I was still introverted and still shy and so on. But with the help of you people, you began to really help me put my life back together again. And I went back to the company, and they began to give me back some of the responsibility they had long since taken away from me. And one day at a time, walking the streets sober and sticking close to AA, why my life began to improve. And it was shortly after that that I got into service work. It really led to my being here at this very meeting tonight. Now, what really happened to me, of course, obviously, the benefits that have come to me are beyond belief, because as I stand before you here tonight, I'm an entirely different looking person, believe me, than I was back in those days when I was 35 pounds heavier, you know, with desiccated arms and feet and a great big swollen belly the size of a basketball and, you know, the yellow eyes and the sallow complexion and the broken blood vessels all over your face and all the charming things that alcoholics have. And, of course, since coming into AA, I've become a physical fitness nut. People say I shouldn't tell this at meetings, it'll drive people away. But I now, you know, I ski all winter, I love to sail, I get up every morning and I run 3 miles every morning, would you believe, with my collie dog bouncing along beside me, and life is so beautiful, and I use this time every morning to commune with my higher power and to ask for my help for the day, and to just to feel at one with the universe, the kind of joy that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. But the thing that I've particularly learned is coming right back to what that old timer told me down there in Houston, Texas, and that is that AA has in these years, it has indeed really taught me how to handle sobriety, as it teaches all of us how to handle sobriety. I mean, this is a sort of a tremendously exciting and kind of mind-boggling thought that is in this very room here. If you think about it, nobody in this room, as long as they stick close to the basic recovery program of AA and continue to come to meetings, none of us will ever have to deal with the problem of drinking again, really. But we have to deal with sobriety every cotton-picking day of our lives. And I think that this is something about AA that's very misunderstood by the civilians on the outside. You know, they say to me, and I'm sure to all of you, you've been sober for X number of years. Why do you still go to those meetings, you know? That's what they don't understand, that we've got to deal with this continuing, we've got the continuing problem with dealing with sobriety, and where we learn how to do it is in these rooms, just like this one right here. And I suggest to you that some of the ways that that we learn this through the AA program and through our sharing is in some of these ways. One, we are told when we first come here that we can't afford this resentments and self-pity, which are the traditional enemies of the alcoholic. And so we are taught how to replace these kind of poisonous thoughts with more positive thoughts. And we get rid of the guilt and the remorse that's been hanging over our life. And we do this, of course, by taking that fourth step and the fifth step, and, of course, the sixth and the seventh and the eighth and the ninth, who all deal with this problem. And then we learn to sort of level out the emotional swings that I was certainly subject to, and I presume that most of the alcoholics are. I mean, one day you'd say, let's get drunk. And then the next day you'd say, I may as well be drunk just the way I am. And somehow in AA, we learn to put our lives on an even keel. a more even keel. And that's not necessarily dull or bad. I mean, the even keel is way up there, so much above the way that we were living when we were alcoholics, that it's simply beautiful. And we learn to differentiate between our wants and our needs. This was something that was a great problem with me. I was always a grasping sort of a person and wanting all kinds of luxuries in life and all kinds of goodies and treats out of life. And every time I get one, there would be another one that I wanted. And so I never did satisfy my wants. And they told me when I came into AA about this, they said I never would satisfy my wants, but that my needs would be provided by a loving God. That's what they told me. And that's the way that it has proved in all the years that I've been in AA. And we learn to get rid of the burdens of the past and to avoid being anxious about the future by learning to live one day at a time in this beautiful program that we learn here in Alcoholics Anonymous, to live one day at a time. We're granted the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, etc. And when that was granted to me, then I lost this sensitivity to criticism that had plagued me, really, all of my life. And this quickness to anger, which had always been one of my problems. But I think most of all, what I have learned in AA, or what AA has given me, is to reject this fantasizing and this living in a dream world that I had resorted to with and without the help of booze most of my life. I yield to no one on this, believe me, friends. I was the world's greatest fantasizer. I mean, I could imagine, you know, at this point when I was striking for this better job in the company, one of the other tapes that I used to play down there in the English Grill over the drink in front of me, well, for one thing, I would always imagine that somebody was going to sort of reach down and pluck me out of there and put me in some very elevated place where everything would be good. And I would play this tape over and over. And when this was going to happen, then I would have to make this farewell address to my troops. And so I used to rehearse this farewell address over and over and over again as I nursed my drink down there. Of course, I got it real down real good, but as I told you before, I never got a chance to use it. But I lived in this dream world and this fantasy world for so long, but when I came to AA, you people taught me how to live with reality, how to face reality, how to come to grips with reality. And behold, we found that it's beautiful. And I think the reason is that at last, we're at peace. We're at peace with ourselves, and we're at peace with our fellow man, and we're at peace with God. Thank you.